Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Modern medicine works miracles. It also breaks the bank, and nowhere more ferociously than in the United States. After a brief pause in the HMO grip of the 1990s, American spending on healthcare is soaring again. By 2014, it is now projected to hit $11,000 per American per year. Costs like that are already hobbling GM. Soon, they could hobble the country. All other developed nations have controls on healthcare spending. Now the call is going up for the United States to ration healthcare or drown in medical bills. That extra CAT scan? Nope. That cutting-edge pill? Not likely. Britons know the drill. So do Canadians. Next may be you. Up next on Point, rationing healthcare in the USA. Joining me now is Henry Aaron. He's senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of Can We Say No? The Challenge of Rationing Healthcare. Henry Aaron, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be with you.
I wish you'd lay out the big pieces of the argument here for us. Why are you talking about rationing in the first place?
I'm talking about it because I think it's a choice that the nation cannot escape. The choice is between devoting ever larger shares and eventually perhaps all of our economic growth to increasing healthcare spending on the one hand, or finding ways to limit the availability of certain forms of care that provide benefits that are less than what they cost.
Henry Aaron, let me ask you, I want to get into what some of those procedures are. We'll talk about that, about what you might like to see American medicine cutting back on in terms of what it offers. But I think a lot of Americans would say, yes, that's what I want. When my life is really in danger, when I'm in a catastrophic situation, I'm comforted by the fact that the sky is the limit, that all this technology and medicine will be brought to bear, and I'll be saved.
I understand that, and it's for that reason that I'm not at all sure that when push comes to shove, the American public will indeed opt for healthcare rationing. But here's the alternative. The alternative would be that by the year 2030, the total amount of taxes we would have to pay to sustain our commitments to the elderly, disabled, and poor, and meet other government obligations, total tax burden would have to increase by more than half. That is to say, the tax collections, which now run about 16 or 17% of GDP, gross domestic product, would have to rise to close to 30%. By 2022, half of all economic growth would be going for increases in healthcare spending. And if current trends were to continue, by 2051, all of economic growth would go for increased healthcare spending.
Those are economist numbers. What would that mean for the economy? I mean, we've seen GM now kind of flirting with bankruptcy, and no small part of that attributed to the healthcare cost of its employees and retirees. If the cost of American healthcare, and we hear you that it's not guaranteed it would go that high, but if it did, what kind of consequences would that have for the U.S. economy?
Well, if employers were to continue to sponsor health insurance, what it would mean is that pay increases would stop for anything other than health care. Take-home pay would be, in effect, frozen at whatever level it was. Conceivably, eventually, and in many industries, one would have to see cash wages, the real purchasing power of them, actually falling because the employer cost of health care would be rising quite fast. Alternatively, employers might say, look, we can't shoulder these costs. We're going to have to cut back on the generosity of insurance, and employees would see that the insurance they have just wasn't covering nearly as much as current insurance does. There'd be higher deductibles, higher cost sharing, excluded services, other changes in health insurance that would change what insurance means.
So you describe Americans looking at a potential economic implosion if they continue to ride this upward curve in healthcare costs. You say, as an alternative, Americans are going to have to, will be forced to consider what you call heretofore unthinkable ways to limit spending. Like what?
Budget limits on what hospitals have to spend is the most frequently used method of control in other countries. In the case of Great Britain, hospitals receive an annual budget each year. If there are very serious, uncontrollable external circumstances like an epidemic, then adjustments can be made.
What would that mean for an individual patient? If I'm in a hospital that's facing budget limits, describe a situation, an example.
In American hospitals, I had a number of conversations with British physicians, including a number of radiologists. One of them said, you know, I was a visitor at the Mass General Hospital
in
their
Boston,
radiology department. When you walk into the radiology department, you look at the floor, and there are a bunch of multicolored lines that point in different directions. One is to radiology of the shoulder. One will be for abdominal radiology. There'll be many, many sub-departments, each of which is adequately staffed. He said, here, we don't have anything like that. We have a few radiologists on staff. They do general services of all kinds. And there are queues, in effect, for use of MRI and CT scanners. What this does is feed back into the way in which physicians practice medicine. A general physician will say, well, I realize that I'm not likely to be able to get an appointment for a physician for a patient with this particular set of conditions. I'll have to tell the patient that there's just nothing we really can do in this particular situation. That has happened in Great Britain, and in effect it still does for a number of different services.
And is that really what we're looking at, what you're recommending for the United States? That the patient's just told by the doctor, it would be great if we could do this, but sorry, the budget doesn't allow for it, sayonara.
In the case of Great Britain, they have had such low spending for so long that the circumstances they face are really quite different from the ones that we would confront. The Brits spend about 40% as much as we do. We spend 2.5 times as much per capita.
Do they suffer from that lesser expenditure?
In some cases they do, and in some cases they don't. It depends on the condition from which that people have.
Henry Aaron, you say that this is going to be a towering challenge. There's going to be a lot of pressure to do it. You say that to accomplish it will require universal health care. That will be an accomplishment in itself. Why universal health care before rationing?
Currently, 15% of the American population is uninsured, but they are not without health care. To some degree, they pay for it, but to a significant degree, they receive it because you and I, who are well insured, either we or our employers pay a bit more than our insurance costs. And those funds are available to hospitals and physicians to cover the costs of care for the uninsured. As expenditures rise, if we want to tamp down or slow the growth of spending for those who are well insured, the first thing that's going to get squeezed will be those extra funds that are available for the uninsured.
Mm.
The result, if we want from increased pressure on from healthcare costs, therefore would be, if not everybody is insured, the result would be, I fear, a truly ferocious degree of denial of care to the uninsured. So much so that as a nation, I think we would find that course of action simply unacceptable.
That is,
I don't underestimate our willingness to see millions of people uninsured, but that system is tolerable to those of us who are well insured. It's not so good for the uninsured, but it's tolerable to those of us who are well insured because one way or another we understand that the emergency room is available, that the doctor will see the patient in extreme need.
So, in effect, I mean, you're raising a really big issue in picture here. If we follow the cost right on up the curve, that you describe, you're saying it, if we do that without universal health care, it will mean inevitably leaving millions not just uninsured but untreated at some level.
That's correct. And I think as a nation, we would find that so odious that we would simply not go down that path.
And yet rationing itself, and you say it again and again in the book, is has long been seen as odious to Americans when it comes to health care. A lot of people want to join us, Henry Aaron, with opinions on where this is all headed. I want to begin to turn to them. Lori is calling from Ashland, Massachusetts. Hi, Lori, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I always love your show, and I think you're wonderful.
Oh, thank you, Lori. What do you think on this point?
Well, I'm appalled at the idea of rationing. And I think that the first thing you have to look at is cutting out waste. It is not anecdotal. It is a fact. I have worked in hospitals in the past, and I have seen the waste that goes on. And even some of the biggest hospitals that cry poverty, believe me, have lots of fat they can cut.
Do you mean wasteful treatments or something else?
Fat and other parts of the budget. Now, I have a story to relate, if I might, very quickly.
Okay.
And I'd love to hear more of your guests.
No.
I am a relatively young woman in my 30s.
Okay.
And I went to the hospital in January a year ago with symptoms of a heart attack. They did the usual electrocardiogram. They tested oxygenation and a few other little things and said, "You're not having a heart attack, honey. Maybe it's acid indigestion." But the reason that I went was because of a numbness in my arm that wouldn't go away and was totally unexplained. And
so how did it all turn out, Lori? What happened?
Well, a neurologist happened to come by as they were getting ready to let me go, and he said, "You know, she is too young to be having these symptoms, and it may not be a heart attack, it may be something else." And he actually fought to have me have an MRI. And we're talking at a Boston hospital. The MRI found a brain tumor. And I'm not saying that rationing is going on now, but it may be at least on a subconscious level. Well, she's too young to have a heart attack, so send her home. And they didn't bother to go forward until this neurologist insisted.
But if there hadn't been a neurologist walking by, if there hadn't been an MRI available, you would have had a brain tumor undiscovered, and Lord knows what consequences.
Exactly. And so I personally am of the feeling that this is not a question of money. It's a question of ethics and morality. You don't deny people food and drink. You don't deny them shelter. You don't deny them health care.
Let me take a call from Toronto, Canada. Don is calling. Hi, Don. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. I'll tell you why I'm calling. I heard you mention rationing up here. I've never experienced any kind of rationing up here. My wife, who was an American citizen, who was very ill, my late wife, received excellent treatment up here. We could change doctors at will and so forth. Here's the point I want to make.
Yes, sir.
I broke my arm in Philadelphia a little over a month ago, less than a month ago, I should say. And my enemy, I received superb treatment at the hospital where I ended up.
Okay.
My enemy was not the doctors or anything of the kind. My enemy was my private insurance company here in Canada, who did not want to pay for it, and I had a running battle for 2 days with them to pay for this, and I've been paying my premiums regularly for years.
Don, you raise a couple of great points there, and let us pick both of them up, if I may. Henry Aaron, first, Don says, you know what, I've never experienced rationing in Canada, even when I had serious problems in my immediate family. What do you make of that? Does Canada have rationing or not?
Canada has excellent access to primary care. Canada has more high-tech medicine than do most other nations, but not so much as that in the United States. It has lower surgery rates than the United States does, but we may well be doing more than is medically optimal. The Canadian health care system is excellent. It is a highly democratic system, but it doesn't have access to all of the services, it has access to all of the different kinds of services, but not in such large quantities as is the case in the U.S.
I want to welcome into our conversation somebody working on the front lines of this whole world. Dr. David Himmelstein joins us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. He's a primary care physician at Cambridge Hospital there. He's an associate professor of medicine at Harvard University. He is a co-founder, along with his spouse, Dr. Steffi Woolhandler, of Physicians for National Health Program. So he's got an advocate's view, but also the view of a doctor who's working it. Dr. Himmelstein, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Henry Aaron says, if we don't want to break the bank in this country, we're going to have to consider rationing, and sooner than most Americans might like. Do you agree? Are Americans going to have to one day live with rationing or get into either broke or severely inequitable delivery of medical services?
Well, I think the key word there is one day. At some point, we may need to do that. But at this point, we're throwing away so much money in our healthcare system. If we just spent wisely and didn't do things that are useless or harmful, and also said to people like Bill McGuire, who's the head of United Healthcare, a big insurance company, we're not going to pay you $125 million in your income. So we're throwing away so much money in our healthcare system and paying such outrageous things.
But are we throwing it away on treatments? Is rationing, in effect, the way of saying, no, we won't throw money away, we're going to clamp down on things of... Henry Aaron says, on procedures or medicines that are not worth the money.
We are throwing some of it away on treatment, and it's not just for things that aren't worth it. It's for things that, in many cases, actually harm patients. So,
like what?
We know that 14% of all the coronary artery bypass surgery that's done is clearly unnecessary. There, you're operating on someone who would be just as well or better off without that procedure. And, you know, no one wants to undergo surgery if you don't need it. We had a hospital in Northern California that was literally doing heart surgery on people with absolutely normal hearts because there was money to be made doing it. So, yes, we're throwing away large amounts of money on not just borderline stuff, but stuff that's actually harmful to patients and useless to many more.
And do you think that this sort of ledger of American healthcare costs could be balanced just by dealing with that waste, or do we have to get into a systematic restriction, that is, rationing of services, Dr. Himmelstein?
For the next 20 years, we could just balance it by stopping doing useless things and getting the waste out of our system, the million people doing nothing but paper pushing in our healthcare system, the outrageous incomes of our drug executives and insurance executives, just rationally organizing our system. I mean, Henry Aaron is right when he talks about the Canadian system as having some very modest limits at this point, but delivering excellent care to most Canadians. But they spend only about $4,000 per person. We spend $7,000. If we had Canadian efficiency and almost twice what Canada spends, we could have a terrific healthcare system for every American.
Alice is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Alice, what do you think?
Well, I must say that I'm 90, so...
Congratulations.
Well, this explains some of my thinking.
Okay.
Over the past 30 years, I think I've had many tests that were not required. But as far as the general picture goes, I think we as a society have become soft, but I do think we could still accept the challenge of facing up to the problem.
You're 90 years old. It sounds like you've had plenty of tests done, and you're saying on this side of all those tests you could have done without most of them and lived and thrived?
They found out what wasn't wrong. I think it's partly the diagnosis. I think it's partly if it's covered, let's do it. I don't know. I don't blame anybody, but I think I'm listening to the voice of reason right now, and the right people have got to figure out how to do it.
Alice, we appreciate your call, and congratulations on hitting that number. We wish you many more. Henry Aaron, a lot of Americans are going to be headed toward 90 soon, but do you see that sentiment that Alice has there saying, take it easy on my treatment. Don't go that extra yard each time. Be careful about that next test. Is that a commonly held American sentiment?
I don't think it's commonly held, but I have to share a story with you. In the course of doing research for this book, I talked by phone to some British radiologists. They said, you do much too much testing in the United States. If you're over 65 and you go in to see an audiologist about hearing loss, he'll do his tests, and then he's going to say to you, I think we should do an MRI. Why? Because there's a tiny, tiny chance that you might have something called an acoustic neuroma. That's a very slow-growing cancer in the ear canal.
Yeah.
3 months later, I came back from a vacation having mistakenly tried to kill a mosquito that landed on my left ear by slapping it.
And sounds hearing like a natural ringing, reaction.
And hearing ringing in my ears for 2 days, I went in to see an audiologist. He did various tests. I went down and sat in his office. He said, you know, he said, I think it would be a good idea if you had an MRI examination. Having had the conversation with the British physician, I said, well, do you think I could wait? And he said, well, yes, of course. He said, if there's no progression, it would be okay.
So you're
and
saying...
I walked out without an MRI.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is an instance where it would have been all too easy for me to have said yes. The standard of practice is, I think, what that audiologist recommended. It's an example of a procedure where the cost per treatable condition, the number of what we call quality-adjusted life years that might have been added, would have cost a very, very large sum, perhaps millions, for finding a treatable condition.
Just for all those left-ear mosquito slappers, if we want to...
Exactly, or analogous situations. That's the sort of thing we do more of than other nations do, and that I think this lady was referring to, and indeed I think is consistent with the sort of limited constraints that Dr. Himmelstein and I both agree occur in the Canadian system.
And yet life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, Americans seem to have a kind of idea that whatever gets us a little closer to immortality is worth spending on. Dr. Himmelstein, let me ask you, I know I've got to let you go in a minute here, but if Americans were as unhappy as they manifestly were with HMO constraints, a lot of pushback, HMO is the butt of every joke you can imagine in the 1990s, if Americans didn't like that kind of constraint, how much less likely are they to stand for the kind of rationing that Henry Aaron is describing?
Well, I think the big problem with rationing in the foreseeable future is people look around and say, why is it that we should be wasting money while we're telling people they can't get care? So when HMOs put in the limits on care that were severe, first of all, they were arbitrary. Second of all, at the same time, Bill McGuire was making hundreds of millions of dollars from doing that rationing.
This is the head of one HMO, yes?
Third of all, they were in effect saying, we're going to snow you under with paperwork, which is going to cost hundreds of billions of dollars in order to save a few dollars on the actual clinical care. You know, there's an old Chinese proverb that says, there's no point in going to bed early to save candles if the result is going to be twins. And in effect, the HMOs spent so much on their own paperwork and their own systems that any savings were overwhelmed by the bureaucracy they put in place. And I think Americans are prepared to say, don't torture me when I'm dying in expensive ways if, in fact, there are no alternatives. But we haven't explored any of those real alternatives in our healthcare system. And my view is if we had a simple, straightforward national health insurance system, we could get rid of so much waste and useless and harmful stuff. We could actually give people high-quality care and not ration for the foreseeable future.
Maybe, though Henry Aaron says that universal health care platform might be just the beginning or the prerequisite for that rationing. David Himmelstein, Dr. Himmelstein, it's great to have your frontline view of how this is all unfolding. We thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Dr. David Himmelstein, primary care physician at Cambridge Hospital in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Henry Aaron, we've just got a couple of minutes here. What happens to the famous technological innovation that Americans are so fond of in medicine if you clamp on these kind of constraints? I read in your book you saying we're going to have to live with less innovation. Does that line up with the American psyche?
I'm not sure we're going to have to live with less innovation. If I said that, I would like to take it back here. I think that caps on or limits on the growth of healthcare spending probably would have some effect on the total pace of medical innovation. But right now, we spend an awful lot of money through private research trying to do what somebody else has done already so that we can get a part of what has been demonstrated as a successful market. A great deal of drug research falls in that precise category, looking for what are called Me Too drugs. Mm. I hope we'll see less of that. But the large-scale opportunities for advance would remain. Professor Victor Fuchs at Stanford University, the sort of senior health economist in the nation, is strongly advocating that there should be public support for research, precisely to encourage the continuation of research, even if there might be such limits. He emphasizes the importance, and I would in this case, of research that serves to limit the growth of spending, as well as research to find new procedures that are more expensive than we had before.
Henry Aaron, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Henry Aaron, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of Can We Say No? The Challenge of Rationing Healthcare. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.